and it's a bit beaten up. I nevertheless presented this talk about 10 times, and every time I got a reaction from the audience, and the pile of transparencies is keeping increasing. So I don't know when this process will stop. So what I want to do is to construct a model in which effectively the available or the propagating number, the propagating degrees of freedom and the number increase so as for them to keep a fixed density. And the way I want to realize this possibility is by using the dissipative effects. Let me explain why I want to do this and in which type of context I want to develop the formalism. So I shall list several motivations and several requirements, and when these are properly understood, it will be clear what should be done with the formalism in order to reach the motivation and to fulfill the requirements. And both the motivation and the requirements could be viewed from different perspectives. You can start with inflation or proceed with inflation with as a motivation or the aim to compute the power spectrum in the presence of this equation. You can stick to Minkowski spacetime and ask how to describe dissipative effect in Minkowski spacetime. And you can also ask yourself, once you have obtained those modified settings, how does this relate with the traditional approach of quantum gravity? And depending on what is your point of view, somehow the requirements and the motivation are not exactly the same, but it can be used for the three of them. So what is the first motivation, the basic motivation, is that I assume that they are unknown high energy processes which break Lorentz invariance by dissipative effects, thereby introducing a new scale, lambda Lorentz violation, and introducing therefore a Brickler frame. And my first aim is, what is the phenomenology of this possibility in Minkowski spacetime in vacuum? That is, what are the relevant quantities which describe dissipative effects only above a certain energy scale? Can I generically parameterize the possibility? What are the relevant objects governing this possibility? In general, irrespectively of the scenario. This is my first. And I shall provide an explicit characterization, if you wish, of this phenomenology. My second motivation is within the inflationary scenario. I assume that everybody knows what is the Transplanckian question of cosmology. And so far, despite 5 years of analysis, only dispersive models were explicitly studied. And there is no systematic analysis of the dissipative fields. And I want just to complete the analysis and provide a class, a generic class of dissipative models wherein the power spectrum P of K, that is the spectrum of primordial fluctuation after inflation, as produced by inflation, can be explicitly computed. So this is my second aim. I want models defined in such a way that I can, at the end of it, compute the power spectrum. Okay. The third motivation is linked to the second one, even though it's a little bit broader. And it's, I want to also to confront, or to be able to confront, the question of mode creation in an expanding or in expanding universes. This is the following question. Let's assume that the mode density, that is the density of degrees of freedom, is finite and not infinite, as it would be in the Lorentz invariant theory. Let's assume it is finite. Once you've assumed that it is finite, there are only two possibilities. Either the number of degrees of freedom is constant, and in such a case, the density decreases like 1 over a cube. And given the fact that the universe, from the beginning of inflation till now, has increased by about 10 to the 50, that is, the volume is 10 to 150, this possibility, I think, is already ruled out. There is no way of assuming that rho m can be finite with the number of degrees of freedom constant or nearly constant. So we are left over with the only possibility that rho m is constant. In which case, we should worry, we should provide a mechanism for keeping that constant in an experimental universe.
Just to rho m doesn't have any constant, right?
No, no,
that
no.
Doesn't have to scale like one of A2, right?
It's exactly what I mean. So when you assume that it does not decrease like 1 over a cube, you have to confront two questions. How to describe mode creation in quantum field theory? You can open it in some Zuber. There are a lot of rules to compute a lot of amplitudes, not to answer that question. There is no way in standard textbook of quantum field theory, a procedure to describe mode creation. And once you've constructed, or you imagine that you have such a theory, you should confront the other question. When you have new state, newly born state, in which state do they appear? In which quantum state? So my aim is to provide what I call Hamiltonian system, or closed system, I shall be more precise in a minute, wherein underdamped modes are created, quotation mark, so as to have their density fixed as the universe. So there will be a constant flow from overdamped mode into underdamped mode as the universe expands in such a way that the density of propagating degrees of freedom stays constant. And I want an explicit model where this is realized, or even a class model. Okay.
The standard inflation, or standard sort of creation of the inflationary balance vector,
yeah.
That's just spontaneous pair creation in the vacuum, but that's like the Schwinger mechanism. So
yes.
That's standard fusion.
Yeah.
So I think if you're definitely going to dissipate the effect, that will not be the textbook.
No.
Creation of what? Of quantum or quantum?
No. Well, if you look at the electron positron creation, it's a constant like
of quantum.
No, I want to create nodes. I don't want
to make quantum. Are you referring to the temperature of the given talking temperature or what?
Yes.
But you're talking about I know.
This looks like it's far more general. Yeah.
We want to make modes.
So my first motivation, that's essentially the end of it. I don't want to stick to a particular scenario. I want, on the contrary, identify what are the relevant properties of the additional degrees of freedom which will govern the dissipative of five. And the reason, I want to identify equivalent class, if you wish, of fundamental theories giving rise to the same phenomenology. I want to be able to characterize what are, if you wish, the relevant properties that will be available in the infrared. And I also would like to cover the generic case. I call this an anti-Hadamard procedure. For exactly the same reason, I don't want to impose a priori properties to the additional degrees of freedom that I shall call psi, that will induce dissipation. I want to stay as generic as possible. In particular, and this is after a discussion 2 nights ago with Ted, in order to be able to meet additional requirements. If some people say your model does not satisfy the requirements, if I have now a class of model, and in principle the largest class of model, I will have the chance to meet additional requirements, for instance, general governance of there will be several aspects of, let's see, gravitational physics that won't be present in my talk. Nevertheless, having a whole class of models, I might be able to fulfill additional requirements. having the whole glass and not a perfect. So what are the requirements, having now listed the motivation? I have basically two requirements, no more. So the main requirement is that is to work in a simpler situation is will be phrased in Minkowski spacetime in a stationary and homogeneous diagram. So I want a model of fields, quantum field theoretical models, in which dissipation arises on shell, which is a very strong requirement because most of the time with relativistic settings, dissipation occurs off shell, not on shell. In Minkowski spacetime, in the vacuum, I don't want dissipation induced by thermal effect. I want dissipation effect in the vacuum and only above a certain energy scale. And I want, as well, just for simplicity, that homogeneity, isotropy, and stationarity will be in the mean exactly physical. When you have this list of requirements, there is only one possibility. The only possible form of the Green function of any theory fulfilling this will be of the following. So the Fourier transform of the two-point function will be a function of both frequency and momentum because Lorentz invariance is broken. Here you get the usual terms, the relativistic invariant second order term. Then there will be an additional term, the self-energy, which will be a function of both omega and k, because it is through that function that Lorentz invariance will be manifested. If it is in relativistic setting, in a vacuum, it's only a function of omega squared minus k squared of one variable, the relativistic invariant. Here it's a function of both variables. And in order to have dissipation only above a certain scale lambda, the imaginary part of that function should be zero up to lambda and then. So I have here already the only possible form of all models that will have dissipation on shell in Minkowski spacetime vacuum above a certain energy scale and phase of energy. And you shall see that whatever the model is, it will be governed by a function of the drivers and nothing else. At least it's two-point function. Yes.
Could you just clarify what you mean by on shell, not off shell?
What's okay.
An example of off shell dissipation?
Take relativistic field theory, interacting, nothing. Generically, any model you like, they will have a sigma that will be a function of omega squared minus k squared, and this function will develop imaginary part for a certain value of omega squared minus k squared not equal to the root. So this is the typical case that you find. You have generically dissipation from the field theory, relativistic field theory. But only if the particle is not on its mass shell.
I'm just asking, I think when you have a dissipation, and so omega is greater than threshold.
In relativistic, no, he said relativistic.
When you're greater than lambda.
Relativistic.
Then what does unnatural mean? Because of the propagator, then generally when you have a dissipation of a branch cut, so it's a linear combination of other stuff. Normally, when you dissipate, you don't have a mode. You don't. It's a wave packet of the Hilbert space, which is well established on Hausdorff. And so, I think the question is well put. What do you mean when you say exactly that it dissipates? When we have a narrow resonance, we have a working in the definition, but. When the imaginary part goes up, that working definition falls apart.
No, the Green function
always
exists.
I think that our natural doesn't work. Well, maybe it's not a material point to debate, because it's just the way you described it. But I agree, it seems ambiguous. But let me ask a more precise question just about what you mean. You drew the graph with omega as the horizontal axis.
This is omega.
Yeah. And not k, for instance.
No, but I put here OS on shell.
So,
treat it perturbatively.
I just want to ask, are you specifying a priori somehow that it's really the threshold of frequency that determines
No, it will be very smooth. You will see explicit example. Take an explicit example. Take that function. Put it here. And
so
then
it could be either one.
the only point, it should be a function of both omega and k.
And if H means angular momentum, is that?
Sorry? K. K is the norm
of H. Is it sigma 0?
Sigma.
Sigma.
Or
the
on shell.
On shell.
On shell is a rough word to say when I don't have this, the pole of the.
So when omega equals k.
Very good. Okay. In that case, I could put a mass. It's a. I mean, perturbatively on shell. There will be two poles. Look at the poles of this. The poles will move as the. So the real, look at both the real part and the imaginary part of the poles. As long as k is, or omega is smaller than lambda v, the poles of this object are very near the real axis, and then they move down of the real axis.
Maybe this good answer is if we switch off the interactions,
no,
which
not
are responsible for the dissipation, and then we know what unnatural means, and then we turn on the interaction and see the destiny of the Green's function of that pole.
The question is maybe vague. The mathematical properties of G's are those ones.
Yeah, that's what I want to say. Really mean in stated physical terms is just that there are no, there's no propagating excitations that just go forever.
Above a certain scale. And
okay.
Below there is. And below there is.
Right.
And it's progressive. You go from one, it's not sharp. It's
okay.
Smooth.
Yeah, okay.
And what I want just to see, to emphasize the difference between former work here, you see, the dispersion relation is not chosen a priori. It appears a posteriori from the definition of the self-energy. So I choose, I put some interaction, I solve for the self-energy, and this effectively a posteriori defines what I call the dispersion relation. It's simply the locus of where the denominator vanishes. So this is my first requirement.
Okay, no, I've always, I mean, if we can just talk freely, I've always been troubled by this question.
No, but I shall solve it.
Maybe
you can ask it again.
And Tremaine wrote a paper in the 1950s. For example,
I think that
the excited state of the hydrogen atom is not a statement over space. It's a linear combination of the ground state and the continuum with the photons. And here we're discussing the proliferation of new states. So the question of the delicate state is, are we to consider, for the simple example of quantum mechanics, are we to consider the excited state of the hydrogen atom a state or not in local space?
And the mathematic, the formalist will give me the answer. Precisely. Just wait. Explicit answer. I will have an explicit representation of the Heisenberg operator at all times.
And the state.
It would be the initial state of the system. So my second requirement is very traditional. It simply that the Green function I shall consider always obtained as the trace over the entire system by the matrix density times my two field operator, which are simply the Heisenberg operator evolving with my entire system. My entire system, I mean the tie field plus the additional degrees of freedom I shall introduce in order to induce dissipation. And I mention this in particular because there has been several models, one of Forster and Jacobson that will be present just after my talk, which is not Hamiltonian and unitary, unlike this one. I think that the one of Athene is no longer, and the next TEBS model won't be either. So it's when you decide to confront the possibility of mode creation, you can either assume that you can either lose the traditional quantum mechanical setting in which the Hamiltonian fully defined for all time what your Hilbert space is, or, which I should do, or leave it, abandon it, and consider more radical possibilities that additional degrees of freedom are added to your Hilbert space at times possible. So I should not consider it, because I think we are not obliged to do it. This is basically, in one word, the main reason for me not to consider this, or I should stick to the standard and to keep my system closed and Hamiltonian. requiring nevertheless the dissipation of mode creation actors. Just in a few words, how does this approach relate to quantum gravity? So what is quantum gravity in very vague and general terms? All quantum gravitational approaches, or all models for quantum gravity, somehow boil down to assume that above a certain energy scale, can be the Planck mass, the notion of the smooth manifold loses its validity and should be replaced by a new structure. And people are very opinionated on what this structure should be, non-commutative geometry, wheel of Strom, string theory, loop quantum gravity. The question I want to address is not so much what is this structure, but instead, how will this new structure affect the Green function of matter field surfing on that new structure? How will be the infrared properties accessible to me affected or not affected by the fundamental structure replacing the smooth manifold notion? Whatever is your favorite model for quantum gravity, the Green function of the matter field will have the following structure. It will be a trace over something of with two field insertion. If you assume homogeneity, you will be able to Fourier transform this C number function, and it will be just a function of the three momentum T and T prime. In any relativistic invariant theory in the vacuum in Minkowski space time, it is always that form. So, what is the form in the quantum gravity? See, this is a very efficient or practical way to ask what is quantum gravity? How does quantum gravity affect or does not affect the two point function of field surfing on that structure?
And by excuse me, in order to define the two-point function, you have to be sure, if you want to keep the discussion general, that we're able to define a vacuum state, right?
There will be a state. If there is not a vacuum state, pick a state, the one you like. In that state, the field might be, should be able to propagate.
No,
infrared, should, there should be a notion of field propagation in the infrared, whatever that state may be.
But in the infrared, the state has to agree with the Minkowski vacuum state.
So, as k increasing, what happens to that function that exists? You see, it's a continuous function. It should not exist and then disappear. Like with two. The Fourier transform should always exist.
No, especially if your Hamiltonian system, reasonable proposals for vacuum state would be that they minimize Hamiltonian. But then you can do again.
No, look, I take a state, I stick to it. I put two field operators at two points, whatever property. I Fourier transform a C number. The Fourier transform must exist. It can, as a data function, the Fourier transform of a function exists.
That depends on your structure. You might not even be able to define the Fourier transform.
There will be something that should be of that type, at least in the infrared, and then that should continuously disappear or somehow extend. It cannot simply not exist at all. Otherwise.
When you go into the ultraviolet, where the dissipation takes place, you pass over to a density matrix or a somewhat of a density matrix formalism.
Everything is included here, and
so it is a density matrix. It need not be a pure state.
It's good.
No, it needs
trace of hope. Trace of hope.
The vacuum will be part.
So a state which in the original Minkowski vacuum was pure can become mixed.
Yeah. I always will write the trace of rho, not at all the k, the bracket, the order in half. And I will focus on this function because that function is the one that will govern the power spectrum in the inflationary scenario. What in quantum gravity, if you adhere to a model of quantum gravity, and if you want to compute within that given settings, what is the prediction for the CMB? The power spectrum in that theory will be given by that function. So the function must be better exist, otherwise you have no prediction for the CMB.
I'm very curious how you define the Hamiltonian setting.
Can I just make a simple comment? If you
depend on the number of interruptions.
This is the perfect
linear.
I'm helping you, okay? At this point, it's perfect to just remember the analogy with condensed matter physics, which just makes
transparent what he's saying, I think. So, I mean, you have effective field theory descriptions of condensed matter systems. The microscopic theory is some complicated thing that's nothing to do with that field theory, and yet you can study experimentally the Green's functions, correlation functions of the effective fields. You know what it means to couple to them, and that's, for instance, how you determine, well, the self-energies of quasi-particles and condensed matter systems.
Well, in condensed matter physics, you have no expanding background. The situation is very different. That was, I mean, long ago pointed out by Veneziano. Here you can do time-dependent canonical transformations. They should not change your observable, but if you define your vacuum state as a minimal, as a state which minimizes the Hamiltonian, then your definition of the vacuum state depends on the canonical transformation.
But I think you're being way too formal. He's just saying, whatever state we're in nature, let's do the experiment. Like, look at the power spectrum of the CMB and see what it is. That's the experiment, for example.
But you have to
define it. Doesn't matter. He doesn't need to define a formal state. He can say, let's talk about the state we find ourselves.
Okay, if you're not interested in the definition, then I don't understand.
Yeah, I think
he's not interested in the definition.
I think that the situation here is more complicated than anything in matter physics.
Yeah.
Because we're going to fall upon the structure to make noise. And when we have a metal, we have an effective Hamiltonian, we have electrons and protons, we divide it, we defeat. But once we do it, we're stuck with the modes, we're stuck with the cores.
Yeah.
And we don't transfer stuff from the core into
the
matter.
But we easily can transfer it. We easily can make a condensed matter model.
Well, we can make
a condensed matter. That's
very
different from
the nature. And that's not what happens in nature. And in nature, we know a metal, you know, there's the bands, the ions, and so on. And we have a good picture. Here, we're confronted with a much more subtle problem where we go upon a structure which is going to be intrinsic but to the thing that the know is introducing, which is dissipation and the elements of the structure are going to deliver the bands, and the bands are going to fluctuate, and it's a much harder problem.
But I agree the problem of actually understanding that structure, that's the problem of quantum gravity. But Renaud's point is simply that without confronting that problem, he can characterize the output of that answer at the level of things we do know today how to describe. And that's all he said in the last slide, I think.
No, but the statement might be gauged, or it might be not
gauged.
That's what Veneziano pointed out. You have to make it in a Hamiltonian set of an expanding space, so that you have to worry about gauge invariant statements.
No, it's true. You're saying I have truth. That is, electrons in a metal will dissipate because of different interactions with the lattice. But in a perfectly transparent way, they interact with lattice vibrations and so on, so their momentum isn't a fixed quantum number, and so on and so on. Here we're asking much deeper questions. We're making the electron stuff. We're making stuff.
No, but you're again asking a different. That's your talk. This is Renaud's talk.
He's
no. Just trying to.
No, I claim it's the same talk.
Well, I think you're missing his point then.
Yes, I am. I don't see how you can talk about the dissipation, which is responsible for the making of modes, unless these modes come from the structure that he's appealing to. That's why he has to reach a density matrix formula. No? You don't agree? Well, let the speaker say what he said.
At least he wants to give a definition, that's a good thing.
It will come. What I'm talking about will appear, will be explicit, not implicit, explicit. So I mentioned several times mode density, so let me just flash a few transparencies to be clear that everybody understands, because there was already a little bit of confusion. So what do I mean by mode and mode density? So the definition of mode is, well understood, it's very simple. Take a free field in an homogeneous space-time, you can Fourier transform it and define mode operators for each wavelength. Each mode operator obeys a free field, an homogeneous second-order differential equation. Each Hamiltonian becomes the sum of the modes, and so each mode has its own Hamiltonian, and the state of the field is simply the product over all wave number type of tensor product of the state of each mod k. So this is the situation when you have three states. You should not confuse the density of particle, the particle creation, with the density of mode and the mode creation. So the density of particle is simply, as usual, the total number, the mean number of particles divided by the free volume. This is little n bar of q, and this is conventionally written as the sum of the whole wave number times the mean occupation number, which for a thermal bath is the Planck distribution. The density of mode is exactly the same thing where you replace the number of quanta by the number of mode to divide by the volume. You have rho n, the density of mode, and this you count one per each wave number. If the theory is Lorentz invariant, of course, this is infinite, and in order to have a finite number, you have no choice but introducing a UV cutoff, and then the density is simply the cutoff of the per power in three-dimensional space-time. Just one slide to mention that even though it is non-conventional, you can introduce in quantum field theory a hard cutoff in the UV and compute observable in the presence of this hard cutoff. For instance, you can compute the cutoff thermal distribution, which is the sum over all frequent momentum up to that hard cutoff of the Planck distribution, and you will get the traditional uncutoff distribution up to negligible corrections, which stays like the inverse of the cutoff over the temperature, beta lambda. Similarly, for vacuum effects like the Casimir effect, if you compute the Casimir effect with the hard cutoff, you will record the Casimir effect and with the uncut theory up to correction factors, which scales as the product of the size of the cavity times the cutoff. And therefore, the observable, even though the theory is very different because we have removed a lot of modes, the observable in the infrared, in the neighborhood of the preferred frame, the observable are not affected. And the only way to see the presence of the cutoff is to use very large boosts, that is to consider the ANOVA effect. And what does a cosmological, an extending background, it's precisely, act precisely kinematically like a that the cutoff that initially was very far from you because of the extension scaled down and can approach you.
Well, this is not completely right what you say. If you have human cutoff space in an unexpanding cosmos, and you have a cutoff and you scatter two high momentum particles.
No, too high. You should probe. You should probe.
And then the scattering will depend on the cutoff.
No, I mean to an infrared property sensitive. Infrared. The cutoff being very high. But very high in an expanding universe is not well defined because of the expansion. Simply there is a scaling.
And I don't know what he's saying.
Okay, you will see.
He's just saying you can see in IR infrared
observable
the effect of the ultraviolet cutoff. Potentially
an
expanding universe.
What? So maybe I should simply skip it. So in an expanding universe that I can consider homogeneity will be preserved. So the notion of mode exists as in Minkowski space-time. The Hamiltonian is still a sum of Hamiltonian, one for each mode. The state of the system, big psi, is still a product of a mode of mode per each sector, at least in three theories. The frequency is slightly time dependent, it doesn't matter very much. What is on the contrary crucial is that the proper frequency and the proper momentum are the conserved for moving momentum divided by E of t, and similarly for the frequency. And modes are labeled by conformal momentum and not by physical momentum. And this is very important for understanding mode creation. So if you consider an expanding universe, of course, the particle density of any conserved number of particles decreases like 1 over a cube. So if universally there is a decrease like 1 over a cube for all particle number density, what about mode density? So this is, I just repeat the motivation to consider the possibility of describe mode creation. So just in 1 second, to present the next speaker talk, the Forster-Jacobson proposal, just to contrast it with what I do, So what they did is they considered a discrete lattice. At a certain time, they decided to add two points. When they add two points, they add two nodes, and they had to choose the state of the new nodes that they were added. So the two properties that shall not be refined in the analysis I shall do is that in this model, the addition of new mode is specified not by an Hamiltonian, but it's done from the outset. And similarly, the choice of the quantum state in which the new mode is also chosen from the outset. And so what I want to remove is the necessity of calling information from the outset to fully specify my observable at late time. I want my Hamiltonian to govern both the description of the mode creation and the specification of the quantum state by just Hamiltonian evolution. So finally, why dissipation? Can we take one step back and say, why do I care so much about dissipation? I claim that dissipation is generic, in a sense, is unavoidable once you assume that Lorentz invariance is broken in the UV. That is, you take a theory. You assume that UV is broken, that Lorentz invariance is broken in the ultraviolet sector by some interactions. That is, there are new degrees of freedom which act in such a way that are there, and their Hamiltonian, their structure is such that they break Lorentz invariance. When you take those dynamical settings, generically, dissipation effects will arrive at when that scale is reached in dynamical settings. So if there exists black and degrees of freedom breaking Lorentz invariance, when a regular mode will have its energy boosted and reach that critical scale, for instance, by the expansion factor, new channel will open. This mode will simply be able to exchange momentum and energy with the Planck and degrees of freedom. And this will cause the propagator of that mode to develop an imaginary path to its Brest propagator, that is to its self-energy.
Generally.
So the GZK is just an example that this. So it's the name of two Russian physicists that describe the fact that when you take this is a Lorentz invariance not induced by some fundamental theory, but Lorentz breaking by the state. You take a thermal mass of photon. You consider very rapidly moving proton in a mass of photon. And you keep increasing, parametrically if you wish, the momentum of the proton into that heat bath of photon. At a certain moment, you will reach the center of mass, the boosted center of mass, the energy so that you can make pi. When that threshold energy, the rest mass of the pi is reached, the proton momentum will decay and the pair of pi will be produced. And in order, there is no way to prevent this phenomenon to occur when you have reached the mass threshold of 2 pi. There is no way to prevent. This is just an example that when there is a possibility, because Lorentz invariance is broken, and that new channel do open, yeah. Dissipation is generic. It's simply unavoidable. So it's not an assumption. It comes together with the assumption that Lorentz invariance is broken in the UV. You don't have supplemented by dissipation as an assumption.
Well, but you assume that it's broken.
Oh, yes.
Why the interaction with
no, interaction is enough to get dissipation. You should not say, and the interaction should be such that dissipation will occur.
No, but Lorentz invariance might be broken in the UV without there being a happening to the UV. It might just be broken in some
completely different way. But I think if you boost, if you cannot, I mean, if you boost, and then you go. If you put a different particle and you go beyond the fifth in Renault's example, but then you go beyond the threshold of a production, then
no, there should be no production.
And then the boosting, yeah, and then the boosting can't be done. I mean, the physics state changes, the things are not Renault's invariant on the boost. I think that's the lesson.
Yeah.
The energy. I mean, would we see this so much unusual effect when we stop to adhere to the light cone?
It seems to me
the energy of accelerating particles so much.
It seems to me that you're saying that
what you have in mind is an automatic phenomenon of that sort, that if you make particles fast enough, given them enough momentum, then they start interacting with degrees of freedom that they could not normally interact with. Yeah. And that would be the reason why there is an ultraviolet cutoff. But maybe there is an ultraviolet cutoff for different reasons. Maybe there's not. I mean, for example, the special relativity. We know that there's a cutoff on the maximum speed, right? And we know that this cutoff on the speed of object is not because an object that is really fast is starting to interact with something that's going down. We know that it's just sheer kinematical effect. It's not because of interaction. So one could imagine that also an ultraviolet cutoff might exist. I'm not advocating that it is so, but I'm just saying it could be that an ultraviolet cutoff exists.
Yeah, for purely geometric illusion.
Purely geometric, without any interaction with anything.
You're possibly
you could. Yeah. I'm just saying it,
of course,
it could
of course,
be possibly unstable against interaction.
I don't know.
I'm just saying there might be a way.
No, I'm not looking for the geometrical option. I'm getting the dynamical channel. So having explained at length why to consider dissipation, now I have to explain how to handle dissipation in quantum field theory. I will proceed so rather technically now. I just remind you in one slide the property, the very simplified property that free modes obey, which allows to quantize the theory easily. Just to point out that this will be lost when one requires dissipation to occur. I will introduce a new set of degrees of freedom that I shall call collectively psi. I will then consider, just to get familiar, a simple case of model, Hamiltonian model, developing some imaginary part of the set energy, focusing on unitarity, how unitarity is expressed, and what does it imply, and what does it mean in the presence of dissipation, thereby answering the question, all the question that was asked. I will identify the two relevant kernels, the only two relevant kernels, which will govern the dissipative effects, the noise in the dissipation kernel, and I will consider a limit which is relevant for inflation, which is the following. You consider that your system has reached equilibrium, that is the golden rule time has been sent to infinity, the system is fully dissipated, and once you have done that, you consider the limit where the coupling constant goes to zero. So what happened to a system which has completely dissipated and then released free? Can I control that limit? And I shall show explicitly what happens in this peculiar limit, that what is left over after the system has dissipated. Once this has been understood, then the application to quantum field theory, Minkowski space-time, and cosmology is rather straightforward. And there will be one point that should be implemented in order to have the phenomenology I want. I want that as my universe expands, the induced proper frequency does not scale with the universe, and this will here, dynamically realized, I will not choose. Lambda does not appear in my action. Lambda is dynamically induced. So this will be dynamically realized by a restriction on the two kernels. So the requirement that as my universe expands, the UV cutoff scale does not scale with the universe will put a constraint on the properties of the only freedom I have, namely to choose the properties of my
environment. What do you mean by the sum of LV, lambda, LV?
The cutoff.
Not the definition.
Violating Lorentz invariance. But it's the. Okay. I had a discussion with Rubakov, I have mentioned the Rubakov work in the really in the appropriate time, if I have time later on. So, free modes, this is very easy. So what is the basic property which is permanently exploited when you have no dissipation? That is that your equation is second order, homogeneous, there is no source term, it is time reversible. That what you do, without even thinking, is that the equal time commutator between your two mode operators, which is one for all time, is realized, if you wish, in terms of destruction and creation operator, which are time independent, and so is one, in terms of the fact, or based on the fact that the Wronskian of two time-dependent positive frequency modes is one for all time. And so you can forget about the equal time commutator because its maintenance in time is guaranteed by the fact that the transition is cancelled. Now just consider for 1 second what will happen if you add an up term in the D'Alembert-Schön equation. So you add minus gamma dt to equation 1. Then the transition still exists, but it's of course no longer conserved. So what does it mean? It means that you have lost the possibility of keeping the one here in terms of creation and destruction operator. There is simply no way to realize the constancy of the equal time commutator in the presence of dissipation in terms of creation and destruction operator. So how do you understand the fact that when there is dissipation, the equal time commutator stays one for all time? And I want to realize this explicitly to see how, what replaces the notion of the constancy of the Vronskian in the presence of this.
Can you be more clear? Because in standard inflation, where you have dt t squared plus
this,
3 8 dt,
this is one.
Then you have Vronskian minus 1.
Yep.
And then you have a linear term in t.
No, the Vronskian is 1.
Yeah, so you have,
yeah,
have linear term t and
Vronskian
as well.
But it can be erased. It's a kind of, there is a field draw definition.
It's not any linear term.
It's not any linear
term. That he's talking about. It's the wrong one.
There is one canonical field.
No. So the okay, in inflation, there is a Vronskian which is one, and you base your quantization on that Vronskian. The A and the A dagger are based with the mode associated to that, and then you multiply your field by a kind of t-dependent function, so that the multiply field is indeed an upper term.
Yeah.
But the field you actually quantize obeys a second order reversible.
One that's a true damping curve.
Oh, that's okay.
Talking about a true damping.
This is apparent damping.
Right.
But I think that physics has to go into this, not just math, because
you would see.
Actually any linear term can be absorbed by redivision of the variable.
Of course.
Have to get it conserved first.
Of course. Not after interaction. For field theory.
Wait, you can?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, you just multiply by the, if it's a constant, for sure.
You
just
the constant.
No, here my physical field is the quantized field.
For a damped harmonic oscillator, I can canonically quantize?
It's not canonical. Anyway, let's not maybe discuss.
Let's try that. We'll talk about it later.
So what happens? So what do I mean by introduce interaction, and I simply add to the free action I formally consider the action for my new degrees of freedom plus an action governing interaction. As I said already, I impose that homogeneity and isotropy be preserved, and therefore my two-point function given by the trace for the total system of the product of two fields will decompose into that form. Whatever is my psi field, whatever is its Hamiltonian, how many fields I have doesn't matter. This object is a C number. It always exists for all environment, unlike the notion of nodes and unlike the notion of bodies of predictions. In the presence of this of interaction, generic interaction, you lose the notion of bodies of transformation. You lose the notion of nodes. You can try to force it afterwards into the other world. But what you keep intact is the meaning of the free field theory of the two-point function at fixed state between the two. This has exactly kept its meaning it had in the field. Exactly. It's just a two-point function of height. In the true interacting theory, in Minkowski, that function that always exists will have, as I said only, the form of structure, whatever the psi are, whatever the interaction are. And if I want dissipation, I want, as I said, the imaginary curve to be non-zero above a certain scale. So now, let's make a pause. Let's consider Hamiltonian unitary models developing.
Let's get this. And your statement is that you originally have a spectrum with respect to an unperturbed Hamiltonian, which is labeled by K. And then you switch on interactions, and you find that your classification of states becomes a suspect because the imaginary cloud of sigma develops. And let me take an example. Suppose we have a particle center, suppose we have a box, a big box, and we have states that classify momentum. And then we leave a potential hole in the middle of the box. Okay? And then when the hole is not too deep, we can still keep the original classification of states and of the area that it could serve, and we will still have a spectrum and the imaginary part of the signal will not vanish. And then if we dig this to the hole too deep, we find that we made a mistake, because then one state becomes bound and we put a state out of the continuum, and then we have to start to work all over again. There is a new representation in which there will not be participation in the state of bound state, and then minus one states in the continuum if we had begun with that. So we have made a mistake, and what you're doing is you're rectifying the mistake that we made by saying that there's an imaginary signal. But that does not. So the dissipation is relative to the representation of the problem that we're using. And given an undeterred spectrum, there is dissipation within that undeterred language. That's enough. Okay. I've said that.
Yeah, I simply don't agree. But the disagreement is only partial.
Do you understand my example?
Very well. I think I did. No, let me say my way of considering the problem. I want precisely to avoid the questions of the states of the system. And this is why I'm only considering the correlation function of two field operators in the truly interacting state.
I think that's good.
Thank you. Because it avoids answering the difficult questions.
We should not hold on to the concept of states.
Very good.
But hold on to the concept of propagation.
Exactly.
And remove the concept of states.
Exactly. And it doesn't matter because the correlation function sticks.
Yes, thank you.
Are you ready for the amount of time? It's okay. I'm about half the amount of transparency. Even not.
To be restrained.
I can accelerate. Okay.
We're trying to finish with an afternoon.
It's impossible. It doesn't matter. Okay. So I will consider a simple Hamiltonian system. You see, since I want the phenomenology, the simplest system will be equally good as a more complicated system. So let's try to construct the simplest system, which is unitary Hamiltonian well-defined manager. The system has been found since about 60 years in the literature. They've been used in very many different situations in a lot of different contexts. They are generally referred as quantum Brownian motion models. They've been used also by Cadet-Ramayet for certain condensed matter properties. They've been reused more recently by Turek to study the coherence. They are always the same model. They interpret the meaning of the variable is vastly different. The structure of the model is always the same. And it's really a class of model. And this model, the class is wide enough so that finally to describe mode in an expanding universe. So what are those models? And how I reach my model from field theory? I assume that to reach this class of model, I make a very fine assumption that can be analyzed and lived later on, is that my total action of my entire system split into uncoupled sectors, each sector being labeled by the wave number, and the degrees of freedom entering the sector key do not interact with the degrees of freedom of the other sector key. Let's make that assumption. And when you make that assumption, you can borrow all the work that has been done and simply write down a sum of three actions that will do the job. Namely, the first term is the free action for my free mode of momentum. The second term is a sum that can be discrete or continuous of my new degrees of freedom. They can have some energy term that I call here big omega. It depends on k. The linear function of k, I, and t. And then there is a coupling constant, which is linear, between the mode I want to dissipate and my new degrees of freedom that will act as an environment, if you wish, on that degrees of freedom. And the coupling constant here can be an arbitrary function of k, the momentum I, an index of bidirectional feet, and then function. So it's really a very large class. And you see immediately that why this is a simple model, it's a quadratic model. So if you know what's a Gaussian integration, you can solve that model without noticing. Okay, so this is those are the models. What are the equations of motion, and how do you get dissipation from those models? It's extremely simple. The equations of motion are linear, both for the phi field and the new field psi. The structure is exactly identical. So what you do to solve the equation of motion is that you take the second equation, you solve it by the Green's method. So any solution of the psi field is the, so there is the homogeneous solution plus a retarded, a solution which is expressed as the retarded Green function of that box operator times the source. This is the generic solution. You take that solution and you plug back in. And so the first term here, plug the psi zero for that term. And then you have the retarded part that depends only on phi k of t. So this is generically a non-local function of phi k of t. You can always make a Taylor development around t prime equal t. And so you have generically, for the generic case, an infinite series of terms acting with time dependent coefficient acting of higher and higher derivative term. This series split very naturally into two different series. There is a series containing an even number of derivatives. Look at the first term, it is just a mass definition, it can be absorbed in a lambda square. The second term here can be reabsorbed in the field redefinition, it just is an underlying. So the first non-trivial term is with four derivatives, and this is precisely what dispersion is about. Dispersive is the first term that was not already present in the differential operator, and that maintains, if you wish, the even character, the reversible character. Then you have the other series, and those terms are governed this equation. And you see that already at this level that in order not to develop dissipation, the system should possess special properties, because generically those terms will be there. So this is the new differential equation. It's a priori infinite, it doesn't matter. I can nevertheless solve that linear equation, still by the same method. Whatever are this Taylor series, the solution, the general solution of that equation, set of equation, is always, can always be written as a sum of two terms. The first term is always a decaying solution, which contains the information about the initial condition of my phi field, plus another term that I call the driven term. It is the term because there is a source. This driven term is the source term times the retarded Green function. That retarded Green function is really the core of the theory. It is the Dresd Green function. It is a Dresd-Green function because the differential operator here already contains the back reaction effect of phi onto phi to itself through the dynamic of psi. So this is really where all the information is into what is exactly the differential operator which takes into account the possibility of getting back some information from the psi. And once you have the retarded-Green function, essentially you have solved the theory. The derivative term contains, therefore, just to repeat, just to conclude, the retarded Green function, which is that given function of time, it's the state independent one, times the source term, which is just that combination. The phi field only knows that combination of the many degrees of freedom. And the final remark, which is absolutely essential, is that this equation that was obtained by classical techniques of integration, it provides the exact equation for the Heisenberg field operator, because the equation being linear, there is simply no modification when I quantify the system. So I have a class of model in which I have, without further ado, if you wish, the exact solution of my Heisenberg field operator. And therefore I can proceed and I compute the Green function in a given state, which without wondering about the state because I am in the interactive. So let's look at the properties of the green function straight away without wondering about the states.
At the initial condition into pure eigenstate of A0.
We shall see. So let's see. Let's compute the first, the simplest one, the commutator. Just wait. Wait a minute. So the commutator, the odd part of the object, so I just take the commutator, I take the total matrix density of my state, my initial state, because I will interact with the Heisenberg picture. This object is a C number, so the commutator is state independent, irrespectively of the state in which I am. The commutator is a state independent quantity. It is always the sum of two terms, always. It is the commutator of the decaying solution that decays in time, because you progressively forgetting about your non-commuting properties, plus a term which is twice the retarded green function times the non-commuting character of your environment. So what is the meaning of the raison d'être of this additional term? It is absolutely essential. In fact, this is the essential part. This is the irrelevant part. Consider, for instance, that ELT prime are separated from your initial time at which you switch on interaction by a lapse of time much longer than the decay rate. In that case, this term is identically zero, and all the non-commuting property come from the driven term, not the decaying term. What is the sum? This term is very easy to evaluate because the equal time commutator, which is one for all time, tells me that the derivative of this function evaluated at any time, whatever size is, must be equal to one. So what does it mean? It means that all the non-commuting properties on my field operator at late time are only due to my environment. So I have a quantum operator, which is a composite operator, quite complicated, that acts only in the inverse space of the environment. And the non-commuting properties of the environment degrees of freedom provide the canonical quantization rule of this rest composite operator. It's exact. This is all order in G, all time, all Hamiltonian models, whatever the degrees of freedom are. If the system is linear, the proof is linear. No, even linearity is even not essential. Hamiltonian character is enough. What about the anti-commutator? And then it's finished. So the anti-commutator, unlike the commutator, is state dependent. It is always a sum of two terms. When initially I assume that my system is factorized, it can be any state. I simply assume that it is factorized. I don't have to assume it. It's simply the writing simpler than I do assume it. So the first term is just the usual expression for the in the free field times the density, the state of my the initial state of my phi field, plus exactly the same type of expression with the initial state of my environment. At late time, as specified above, only the driven term counts, only this term counts. This term becomes absolutely negligible. And so only the state of the environment matter at late time. So I have an operator which at late time is entirely governed by the environmental, the driven part of the solution. Okay. Now, if in addition, in this type of model, I assume that my two initial states are constant, the commutator and the anti-commutator I just consider provide the building block for all observable built with phi. So if I know the commutator, the commutator, I can compute just by algebraic rules all observable restricted in the phi system. And so the entire information of my theory is in the two kernel N and D, the commutator kernel and the noise kernel capacity. So if I have another theory, very different settings, which induce finally, after having traced out the same function of time, those theories form an equivalent class, as long as all observable in the phi sector are constant. I cannot distinguish them. All observable will behave in an identity. because our observable built with file only contain information already present in the commutator and the anti-commutator. In GA and GC, there are just two data that matters. So the only information that is received or borrowed from the environment are in two functions of time, irrespectively of the degrees of freedom, the stuff, that just two functions of time encode the entire set of information.
Are you talking very much like the Van Hove in 1955, who began with a pure state, every molecule in the gas, whether in a momentum eigenstate, and a dilute gas, no matter what the initial distribution was, and you have an H term and the entropy increased, and in the exact same procedure, the G squared T with T going to infinity, T squared going to zero, it's equivalent to cross graining in a sense, and you go generically to the equilibrium. It's very similar.
So now that I've understood that, I ask an essential question. Because how much should be known, or how much should be imposed on the psi to have decent physics? What should be known about quantum gravity, or let's say the ultra high frequency degrees of freedom, in order to have a decent quantum gravity?
Well, actually, no. How essential was it that you assumed the psi to be quantum?
I will come back to this later. I have a transparency. I cannot start with it. So what should I impose? Which condition should I not give up? I'm ready to do anything, but what should I keep in order to have this? So what is the minimal, or what are the minimal assumptions that I cannot give? In order to answer this question, let's Fourier analysis and use stationary situation, because there it will become very clear what should be, what should not be, what should be kept. So, you see, when the situation is stationary, it requires two things. It requires that all the functions that appear in my action be constant. And it requires as well that the kernel, the two kernels that control everything, be functions of a difference of time. When this is the case, whatever the system is, I have what's called a stationary situation. I can Fourier transform all my system, and the complicated convolution in time became just a product in frequency. So I algebraically solve the problem, and what do I get? So when my environment degrees of freedom are just a function of the difference in time, it means that they are in equilibrium, in a certain sense. And so they will always satisfy a fluctuation dissipation condition. That is, the Fourier transform of the noise kernel, the anti-commutator, will be related to the Fourier transform of the commutator by always by a factor which is 2n plus 1, the mean occupation number, times sine of omega. Whatever canonical theory I'm dealing with in equilibrium, in stationary situations, this equation will be found. There is simply no way to not to find this in a stationary situation in the presence of interactions. The thermal states are the only stationary state of interaction. Because this equation is satisfied for my environment, at late time, the Fourier transform of my system will also be exactly the same equation. That is, the Fourier transform of the anti-commutator will be related, whatever my theory is, to the Fourier transform from the commutator by exactly the same factor, 2n plus 1, sine of omega, and it simply means that the field phi will have reached equilibrium with its environment, probably exactly like the Van Hove case we just mentioned. So, you see, I have an enormous reduction. So, what is the proof? What is the proof that this equation implies that equation, it's the proof is one, right? You simply look at the equation defined in the commutator and the anti-commutator in Fourier transform, and you see that they are related to the kernel N and D in their series simply by the same factor, which is just the product of the Fourier component of the retarded function. So however complicated is this function, the ratio of N over D is the ratio of G. whatever is here. There are cases where the retarded Green function cannot be computed, it doesn't matter. The relationship between one to the other is always 2n plus 1 epsilon. Whatever the environment is, it has to do with unitarity, in fact, and stationarity. So this is two important consequences for vacuum physics first. So in the true vacuum, the occupation number is zero, so 2n plus 1 becomes 1, and so the two functions are related just by sine of omega, and this is just what we need, because when we compute the so-called white matter, that is just the sum of the commutator and the anti-commutator, just by 5, a theta of omega appears, so only positive frequencies are present in the true interacting vacuum, simply because the fluctuation dissipation relation. So irrespectively of my model, I will find that only positive frequencies appear in the true vacuum for the two-point function of my Heisenberg field operator. And this is not perturbative in G squared. If you start to expand in G squared, you won't find it. It's only after having recent the series that this is an exact result.
Don't you assume that you have a physical Hamiltonian which really generates time translations?
I start with the action I'm considering.
But that might be a non-trivial problem.
It might
be a non-trivial.
Not at this level, because for instance, I consider just a few. I've assumed you might. The problem you're raising, you should have asked it before. When
I was thinking about it for a long time.
S is a function of momenta that contracts at each momenta.
Yeah.
This can be rejected. Let's proceed before question. So I assume that ST is equal to this structure, and that each action here, action density, evolves in the position from each other. If you buy this, there is no further assumption that we may get from this. Of course, this can be
contested. That's a very strong assumption.
It is a strong assumption. It simplifies life. And at the end of it, when you have understood the structure, you understand that you can remove it. But the structure is so simple that let's take the benefit of assuming it first to understand what we're doing. Très bien. So I'm after the minimal assumption. Now I have them. The fact that only the vacuum, that in the vacuum, only positive frequencies appear for my Riemann function is guaranteed for all degrees of freedom, all entire field, which obey the vacuum fluctuation and dissipation relations. So what does it mean? It means that the psi I cannot be stochastically fluctuating value. We cannot assume that there is some kind of classical physics at the Planck level to which we shall govern, because if those degrees of freedom are classical, they won't obey the quantum fluctuation dissipation relation, and you will lose, for your observable, its own canonical commutation property. So stochastic variables are excluded in order to have good behavior in the infrared for your dress field. It's simply this possibility cannot be adopted. You can even not adopt a cocktail of quantum and classical ones. You will lose the non-commuting properties of your field because of its coupling. So you cannot imagine to have some classical physics at the, whatever it can be, at the Planck scale, because it will contaminate you progressively, and after a long time, you will lose the commuting properties of your infrared field. Whatever you do, it's excluded, forbidden. On the contrary, the psi field, that cocktail, can be any composite of it. It need not be a linear. It should not be a linear superposition of canonical field. You can take psi squared, chi squared, chi 4. Any power is accepted. Respect at any time. If you take in the vacuum any the relationship between the commutator and the anti-commutator, whatever the composite character of the degrees of freedom, if they are all canonical, they will always obey the vacuum fluctuation, thereby guaranteeing that in the vacuum, my system will have its white matter function just composed of positive frequencies.
So how can you define the vacuum now? Because now you use it.
No, I simply say that the psi field that acts here need not be.
Oh, that's okay.
In the Kant state, I always only consider Hamiltonian systems. So I have to, if you want an explicit example, realization, you have to choose an Hamiltonian. So I assume that the Kant state exists for my environmental degrees of freedom.
And you mean a physical Hamiltonian, not a Hamiltonian constraint? So
no, this guy here. The DDP of this guy. No. So I just want to say here that the linearity I have adopted is not necessary. It simplifies life, it's not necessary. So what happens with phi is composite?
It sounds very powerful.
So you nevertheless lose nice properties, but you don't lose much. What?
I mean, one can wonder why the inflaton, for example, is a quantum field. And you seem to be getting to it.
I think it's forbidden. If you couple to it, if you're on quantum mechanics nowadays, you better. You need to be strictly uncoupled. So I think it really prevents the hole that somehow quantum mechanics appear in the infrared. I think it's not allowed for any coupling. So what happens if psi is a composite operator? Of course, the theory became more complex. The self-energy is not a g-squared term, it's a simple g-squared term, because the one-loop expansion is no longer exact, so you have a series instead of just one term, and you will also generate higher-order correlation function of the phi field. But you will keep intact the simple relationship between the Fourier transform of the commutator and the Hamiltonian. What should I do? No, it's 1/3. Even not. Where did it say 1/3? Less than 1/3.
Well, you started it visually. We can understand why you didn't sleep last
night. I didn't do. Certain are older. The age of the transference is very similar. The next one is 2 years old.
It's a 1/3 left or a 1/3 that you finished?
No. It depends on your question. It's less than 1/3. It's more like a 1/4.
Remaining?
Yes. I'm tired anyway. So what do I want to say?
Maybe if you.
We can have coffee.
If you go, maybe another 10 minutes because you started late, and we have coffee, and then maybe, you see, it might be that something else opens up in the schedule and we find extra time.
Okay, let me just.
So if you go on for
okay, let me just make 3 transparencies and not say a word about the application to quantum field theory in cosmology. Let's consider what happens in the deep dissipative regime, so to speak. So what happens if I'm considering the following? I look at my system at late time in the units of the decaying rate. That is, my field operator is only, the Heisenberg field operator is only composed of my composite operator acting in my environment or made of environment of freedom. And once I am in that regime, I adiabatically switch off the interactions. So what happened to a composite operator acting only on the environment when it becomes free? What happened to this poor composite operator? It only acts there and then you switch it off from that decay. So the first condition, as I said, implies that only the driven part remains. So find the Heisenberg field operator at those times act only on the Hilbert space, only on the Hilbert space, the initial Hilbert space of the environment. Then I apply the free limit. So what happened? I get that my kernel starts with G squared. So it is as if my nothing would be left, because the noise and the dissipation that create that object goes to zero as well, like G squared. So what happens? when I compute g squared times the retarded Dressing-Green function, the retarded Dressing-Green function in the non-perturbative regime developed a 1 over g squared that exactly cancels the g squared from the noise and relieves the 1 over 2 omega exactly when g squared varies. Exactly the same for the anticommutator. That is, you recover, even though you start with a composite operator that only acts in the Hilbert space of the environment, when that composite operator becomes free, that means the g squared to zero limit, it behaves as if it has its own Hilbert space, even though it still acting on the environment. So, conclusion? Sorry, composite operator.
It's just the analog of the Weiss-Wigner theorem where the g squared. Well, the chief squares cancel the numerator and denominator?
I don't know. Maybe. It should be. So the implication is that by analyzing today the psi observables, we have no access to the constituents of nor the Hilbert space on which that operator acts. It does not act on its own Hilbert space. It's still acting on the Hilbert space of the environment. Okay, so this is so one remark and then one little analysis and then I stop. So I mentioned many times that I want m sigma to be different from zero. And I consider so far a discrete set of environmental degrees of freedom, sum of I, ji, psi I for everything. Since this system is exactly solvable, you can actually compute the imaginary part of the self-energy in this system. It is always zero. And it's not zero unless you replace it by a discrete continuous. You need a dense number of degrees of freedom of your environment in order to have this equation. Because otherwise you have a sum of poles and you need actually a cut. And this is because you have an integral over poles. So once you do this, when you introduce that additional continuous variable, it is as if you have an extra dimension. So it's very similar to the brainwall scenario. And actually, if you look at the literature, in certain scenarios, you exactly get the model I'm considering, where the environment degrees of freedom are called there the pulse points. So you can view the set of fields coming from a five-dimensional analysis as one possible realization of the models I'm considering. So if you don't like dynamics, if you like geometry, five-dimensional geometry, you have this class of model from a purely geometrical starting point. It boils down exactly to the same stage. One transparency investor. The theory I'm describing is governed finally by one quantity, which is the behavior of a retarded Fourier transform of the retarded Green function. And it has always the same structure. So let me explain to you what is the structure of that function and how it evolves when you increase the dissipation or increase the coupling. So this Green function is just the inverse of the differential operator, so there is the usual term minus omega squared plus the frequency, plus the m sigma term that I take for simplicity to be linear, it needs to be odd, it's always odd, times a certain function that I call gamma car that will govern the dissipation rate. So it has always two roots, and the property of those two roots, because it's a retarded object, they are always below the real axis. When the dissipation rate is very small, they are extremely close to the real axis, and as g increases, as the dissipation rate increases, if you imagine parametrically, or in cosmology as a function of time when you go back in the past, the dissipation rate increases, the two poles migrate in the imaginary part, so the decay time decreases, they merge here, and then they keep moving on the real axis. So when this regime is reached, you have what is called the overdamped regime, which is reached, and when in all of this migration, you have the underdamped regime. And so you see already that if you have a parametric evolution due to the scale factors. You can start here in the UV with overdamped modes. As the universe expands, the proper frequency decreases, the coupling constant decreases, the two poles merge here, then the underdamped region starts, and as the universe keeps increasing, the modes get released as usual modes, even though they only refer to the environmental degrees of the. So, I said that.